He's working it. He's trying to come up with a solution, and we're waiting to see what they are going to agree to amongst themselves to see whether or not we're going to agree to that.
The Legislative Chess Game. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, April 19th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an early start to the fire season and a warning.
You can be held accountable for the suppression cost, twice the suppression cost of that fire.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The weeks are counting down until the first salmon return home to Alaska rivers and streams. Alaska's people live lives that are deeply connected to salmon. Alaska's economy and families are fueled by these relationships. Learn more about Alaska's salmon at salmonlife.org. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Progress on the state government budget has slowed to a crawl this week, but Governor Bill Walker remains hopeful the legislature can reach an agreement on an oil and gas tax bill that's at the center of budget talks. Walker says there are good ideas for reaching an agreement, including provisions in the Senate version. That bill would end credits for small Cook Inlet producers, but the Senate bill wouldn't save the state as much as Walker's proposal, a fact the governor noted yesterday.
I thought it was pretty good. It's pretty close to where we are. And you know, it's not a matter, it has to be exactly my plan necessarily, but whatever we don't do in that regard, whatever we, you know, dollar-wise, we need to find that someplace else.
Republicans lead large majorities in both of the legislature's chambers, but the House minority has leverage. That's because a three-quarters vote is needed to spend money from the Constitutional Budget Reserve. House Minority Leader Chris Tuck says the House majority has to decide what it wants in an oil and gas tax package. Speaker Mike Chenault sent the House bill to the Rules Committee last week.
We're united on our side, what we want to see. But the reason why that bill got kicked back over to Rules is because it would have failed on the floor. And it would have failed for different reasons, but it still would have failed. We want to keep that alive. We want to keep things working. Chenault has a lot of different characters in his caucus. He's working it. He's trying to come up with a solution, and we're waiting to see what they are going to agree to amongst themselves to see whether or not we're going to agree to that.
Members of the Republican-led House Majority Caucus have been discussing oil and gas tax credits in private meetings. Progress is occurring on a separate area of the budget, one that will affect all Alaskans. The House Finance Committee is discussing a bill that would draw billions of dollars from the Permanent Fund Earnings Reserve. The bill would cut permanent fund dividends in half. The largest version of the permanent fund bill includes The latest version of the permanent fund bill includes a provision that would limit fund spending on the government as oil revenues rise. Once oil revenues reach $3.1 billion, no money would be spent from the fund. House Finance Co-Chair Fairbanks Republican Steve Thompson noted, if the legislature doesn't take any action on the permanent fund, the earnings fund would be exhausted in a few years. That would eliminate all dividends. Walker says there's common ground on the permanent fund issue.
I think that's moving along pretty well. I don't think we're very far apart on that at all at this point. So I think it's getting much closer. So I'm quite optimistic about that piece of it coming into play this year.
Construction has begun on the Capitol building in Juneau. Only the Finance and Conference Committees, as well as House Rules, are scheduled to meet tomorrow. State workers wouldn't see pay hikes based on experience until oil prices rise sharply under a bill introduced in the House yesterday. House Bill 379 says the legislature plans to approve contracts with public employee unions that suspend step increases until after oil prices average $90 per barrel for a year. Legislative leaders have been looking for ways to reduce the state budget as they weigh cuts to permanent fund dividends and oil and gas tax credits. It was the only bill introduced yesterday, the first day after the scheduled end of the legislative session. An enormous share of Alaska's food, fuel, and supplies come into the state through just a single access point, the Port of Anchorage. Even small communities in distant parts of the state rely on the steady flow of goods over the port's docks. In the first part of a series on the port, Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes takes a look behind those numbers.
On a crystal clear morning, semi-trucks are barreling up and down long drawbridges that connect the asphalt docks of the port to the belly of a massive container ship. I thought there'd be cranes or something like that, and instead there are just literally tractor trailers driving in and out of the ship. Twice a week, cargo ships from Tacoma dock at the port. I'm staring at the one run by Tote Maritime, and for hours, a frenzy of heavy equipment moves almost 500 containers onto shore. Billy Goodwin supervises operations for Tote and says this is one of the most essential links in Alaska's main supply chain.
Everything you see in the store comes up either on this ship or the ship next door over there at Matson. Small amounts of stuff come up over the road, but pretty much everything that comes to Alaska comes on one of these two ships.
For the Rail Belt and Western Alaska, it's these ships that haul up a vast spectrum of goods. As Goodwin is talking, we see trucks leaving the ship carrying pipes, heavy equipment, a 20-foot V-hulled boat. In the parking lot are about a dozen single-story homes.
I believe we only had four today.
I would never think that you could ship up whole modular houses.
Yep, those come up just as you see them there.
Goodwin drives us onto one of the ship's five decks, filled with a chaotic ballet of trucks negotiating tight bends and somehow avoiding collisions with each other. Containers are squeezed like Pez candies into every available corner of the vessel.
It's just a big parking garage in here for trailers.
We park, and Goodwin walks me up a few spiraling staircases to the bridge of the ship. And from there, you look out over the port's enormous staging area, packed with elaborate grids of containers arranged according to what has to be moved where at what time.
No one ever sees what happens here, so the first row of trailers that you can see over there past the little bunch of cars, that's our reefer rows. That's where we plug like the perishables and stuff in that you were referring to and stuff. And then as we go out to row 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, that's just our main yard. And then we got Shorty row over here, line haul area.
On average, a full-length Connex container loaded up with what's called FAK, freight of all kinds, weighs 30,000 pounds. The volume of goods pouring off this one ship on this one single morning is staggering.
If you eat it, wear it, use it, or drive it, it's on the ship.
Grace Green is a vice president and general manager for Tote Maritime in Alaska, and her office overlooks the company's ship as it unloads. Tote rents one of the terminals that stands to be improved if funding moves forward for the port's modernization project. And Green thinks that Alaskans don't always understand the port's role as a critical piece of infrastructure, not just for Anchorage or South Central, but for the whole state.
Everything that comes in here, like I said, 85 to 90% of the freight that comes to the state comes here through the port of Anchorage, comes on one of these ships, and then it gets distributed out either on trucks, on rail, or via air to nearly every single community in the state.
85 is the percentage of cargo coming into South Central Alaska in containers and rolling off of the ships like totes. When you look at all of the cargo coming into the state by air, by road, over water, the port handles half of everything coming into the state. And while a huge share of the fuel for cars and trucks moves through the port as well, there's one figure in particular that I really want you to hold on to. Of all the aviation gas used in Alaska, pretty much all of it comes through the port of Anchorage. And as if to stress that point, our conversation is suddenly interrupted.
And so we expect to be here for another 40 years and 40 years after that.
It's not new because there's
a plane going by.
Yeah. It's kind of hard to hear at the end, but in the corner of the room, Green's senior operations manager, Michael Thrasher, says that's fuel. And what he means is that fuel for the jet planes flying training runs out of J-Bear came through the port. That's also true of the commercial jet fuel that supplies large airports, as well as the armada of small planes knitting together communities off the road system. After Green and I talk, I drive a few miles down the road, the same way a cargo container travels, to a breakdown center, which you can think of as like a big sorting room, but with forklifts. It's managed by Carlisle, a trucking company owned by the same parent corporation that oversees Tote. As trailers are backed up to the cargo bays, operations manager Tom Hubbard opens one of the containers from that day's ship and points to labels for where the products are bound.
Fish House and Seward. I mean, as you can see, the stuff comes off. This is probably paper for Office Max.
About half of everything shipped on a delivery like this one eventually moves on to communities beyond the municipality.
So stuff that goes from Anchorage to Fairbanks to Kenai to Seward to Prudhoe, all throughout the state. We'll do the same thing and then backfill these trailers. to send them on to where they're going next.
The whole operation hinges on ships being able to dock and unload at the port. And in part two of this series, we'll look at why that key step is threatened as the port's basic infrastructure erodes into the sea. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
A video showing just how much freight comes off a ship in a single day can be found on our website, alaskapublic.org. An outdoor education instructor who was injured in a bear mauling near Haines on Monday is said to be in serious condition at Providence Hospital in Anchorage this afternoon. This is an improvement from this morning when he was in critical condition. 35-year-old University of Alaska Assistant Professor Forrest Wagner was with a group of 11 students and two teaching assistants on Mount Emmerich on Monday when Wagner was attacked by what state troopers say was a sow with cubs. Wagner is an experienced outdoors instructor and guide who has taught at UAS since 2006. University spokeswoman Katie Bosler says outdoor studies professor Kevin Cryan flew to Haines from Juneau to be with the students after the attack.
The instructor who's with them says the students are doing well and that he's very proud of how they conducted themselves in getting Forrest to safety, utilizing their wilderness first aid and mountain safety skills.
Bosler says the students were on a five-day mountaineering one class that was scheduled to end today. She says they were descending Mount Emmerich when the attack happened. Local police received a call just before noon on Monday from a student who had hiked down to get a phone signal. Trooper spokesperson Megan Peters says today that one person who was there said they saw a bear cub, so troopers are assuming it was a sow with cubs that attacked Wagner. Peters says she does not know if it was a brown or black bear. The class was evacuated from the area by Temsco helicopters. Wagner is originally from Fairbanks. He teaches mountaineering, backcountry navigation and travel, ice climbing, rock climbing, and outdoor leadership, and has led many expedition courses. He has also worked as a guide. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the island community of Diomede gets some help in the federal FAA budget.
To have to go back to the state every year, not knowing whether or not we're going to this year be able to keep the Diomede funding in the state budget is, it's horrible.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
Alaska Public Media is seeking donations for our 2016 Big Alaska Statewide TV Travel Auction to be held on May 19th and 20th. We're looking for trips, accommodations, activities, and adventures. Your generous donation will help us in our commitment to growth and excellence in programming on Alaska Public Media. There's more information online on our events page on our website at alaskapublic.org.
The season's first wildfires are getting attention. The Alaska Interagency Coordination Center reports a 25-acre blaze in the Palmer area being worked by 13 firefighters, with smaller blazes in the Mat-Su, on the Kenai, and in the Fairbanks area drawing responses or being monitored in recent days. KUAC's Dan Bross has more.
The early season wildfires are attributed to human causes. Division of Forestry spokesman Tim Mowry says burning of brush and trash are common in the spring and often result in wildfires.
We've seen a lot of problems with burn barrels as far as fires escaping. Just because you have a 55-gallon drum with a couple holes in it doesn't make it a good burn barrel.
Outdoor burning requires a permit, and Mowry says that's been expanded this spring to include use of burn barrels. Mowry says failing to follow burn rules can result in citations and fines if you start a wildfire.
You can be held accountable for the suppression cost, twice the suppression cost of that fire.
Aside from human-caused starts, Mowry says the state is keeping an eye on two coal seam fires that have sprung to life in the Healy area.
They're sort of burning all the time, and then when you get in some warm, drier weather, they can pop up and produce flames, produce smoke, which is sort of what's happening now.
Mowry says the coal seam fires are active earlier than normal, but will only be fought if they escape to surrounding lands. The season's first occurrences of another common source of wildfire starts, lightning, have been reported in the interior. National Weather Service meteorologist Dan Hancock lists three strikes recorded in the Fairbanks area over the weekend.
There was one northeast of Delta Junction up in, I believe, in the Good Pasture drainage. couple over toward the Canadian border. And then we had one just south of town, just across the river.
Hancock says lightning results when a layer of cold air overlays moist, warm surface air, causing convection, a condition more common later in the season.
It's a little early. Sometimes we won't see any convective action until May.
Hancock says the recent strikes are not expected to kindle fires because of wet ground conditions in the strike zones. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Slade Martin was in foster care for 14 years. He says it wasn't easy because people make a lot of negative assumptions about foster kids.
They're going to steal, that they're going to be a bad influence on the younger kids, that they're going to, you know, get pregnant or get someone pregnant. They're going to be on drugs. They're not going to go to school.
He says sometimes he and other kids did bad things because they felt like they didn't belong with their foster families or anywhere else. They couldn't express themselves through their own clothes, music, or culture. But now foster parents are trying to change that so kids are more successful. Alaska Public Media's urban affairs reporter Ann Hillman has more in part two of the series Fostering Our Future.
After you're done typing it, get the color pencils from Latavia. So you can color it.
Laura Ingham calls homework instructions up to her daughters as she heads to the basement to show off multiple years' worth of family portraits.
This is my oldest son, D'Angelo. And these are my boys.
Right now, she has six kids, though two have moved into their own apartments.
The best times is when they're all here, because this house is just popping. It's just loud, and I just sit and watch all the and my oldest two are so animated.
Ingham knows what it's like to be in foster homes. She and her older brother spent most of their childhoods in them.
I got put with a lot of white families that didn't know how to take care of black kids, and so it makes it difficult.
She says they bounced from placement to placement because 20 years ago, the state didn't value permanency. She shut down. She learned not to attach and not to love.
I was in foster care. It didn't really feel much.
Then, 12 years ago, she took in her younger siblings and everything had to change. She had to learn to open up. When her sister left the house, Ingham started taking in teenagers and has up to 5 kids living with her at a time. Ingham says she and other foster parents are approaching foster care differently than when she was in the system.
They weren't really trying to incorporate you into what they really had going on. It was just like, it was actually a temporary thing. And now they're advocating more for permanency and in actual homes. That was not happening back then.
Ingham cares for teenagers who most likely cannot be reunited with their biological families, which is different from younger kids who will likely go back. The median length of time spent in foster care in Alaska in 2015 was only 1.5 years. But some ideas for making kids feel less stigmatized apply in all situations. Now, foster families are trained to learn about the kids' cultural backgrounds and cook foods from their homes. They learn about the impacts of trauma, how it can affect a child's behavior, and how to react to it. Eileen McGinnis is the director of Alaska Center for Resource Families, which trains foster parents. She says foster families may only be together for a short time, but the parents' attitudes can make any interactions impactful.
Show them that there's hope in the world, there's people that love, there's people that care for each other, and that being in a family doesn't have to hurt.
Ingham says she builds her family by getting the kids to try new things together, at least once. She remembers dragging her youngest son, Evan, to climb Flat Top Mountain.
But he was like, oh, I don't want to go. I just want to go play basketball. It's the summer. He was the first one up Flat Top. He was up there waiting for us and ready to take pictures and selfies and all this crazy stuff.
She glances back at the row of portraits and points to a picture of Evan from when he first arrived at her house, and then a new picture from 3 years later.
If you just look at his face, how his face is changing from when I first got him. There's a smile where there was nothing when I first got him.
Ingham says making kids feel like they're part of a family doesn't always work. Some kids have left her home because they were violent. She's had fights and holes punched in her walls. She says it's not easy, and foster parents need patience. But her trick for helping kids heal from trauma and abuse? Love. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, fueling philanthropic programs dedicated to creating educational and professional opportunities for Alaska Native people.
Alaska Public Media is seeking donations for our 2016 Big Alaska Statewide TV Travel Auction to be held on May 19th and 20th. We're looking for trips, accommodations, activities, and adventures. Your generous donation will help us in our commitment to growth and excellence in programming on Alaska Public Media. There's more information online on our events page on our website at alaskapublic.org.
For decades, Diomede has scrambled to fund reliable air carrier service. Today, the small island community got one step closer to a long-term solution for passenger travel and mail delivery. As KNOM's Emily Russell reports, the U.S. Senate voted to reauthorize the Federal Aviation Administration with a new amendment that would guarantee federal funding for the Village of 100.
Diomede is smack dab in the middle of the Bering Strait, closer to Russia than it is to the continental U.S. The remote community relies on air carrier services for everything from milk to medication. That's why an amendment to include Diomede in the FAA's reauthorization bill is a big boost for the community.
This is a huge, kind of fundamentally important life, health, and safety issue for them.
John Bioff is an attorney for Kuwerik, the native nonprofit corporation for the Bering Strait region. Up until now, Bioff says he struggled to secure steady funding for air carrier services to the island.
To have to go back to the state every year, not knowing whether or not we're going to this year be able to keep the Diomede funding in the state budget is, it's horrible.
In 1978, the FAA established the Essential Air Service, or EAS, program. It subsidizes air carrier services to small communities throughout the country, including 60 in Alaska. But Diomede isn't one of them. It's had to rely on a mix of state and federal funding, which Kuwerik reapplies for each year. In 2015, Diomede received about $190,000 in federal funding and relied on state grants to double that. Senator Dan Sullivan learned about Diomede's dire situation a few months back. He's on the Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee.
I recognize how difficult any kind of economic issues are without essential air service, particularly in some of our most remote locations. So we got to work.
The FAA reauthorization bill sailed through the U.S. Senate 95-3. The House is working on its own FAA bill, which does not include a special provision for Diomede. That one is bogged down over a controversial section that would privatize air traffic control. Reporting in Nome, I'm Emily Russell.
Subsistence hunters in Alaska's North Slope Borough have harvested a 41-foot bowhead whale, marking the fourth animal that has been captured during the borough's spring whale hunt. Benjamin Frederick Tagaruk and his crew brought in the whale on Saturday in Wainwright. The captain's father, Terry Tagaruk, says whales seem to be making an appearance earlier than usual this spring. The weekend's harvest comes after a crew in the village of Point Hope landed a whale on April 10th. A 43-foot female bowhead was harvested on April 5th, and a 42-foot male was captured on March 27th. Alaska charges cruise ships that stay three or more days in state waters a $34.50 tax per traveler. It's called the Commercial Passenger Vessel Tax. The tax brings in millions of dollars each year, much of which the state distributes to cruise ship port communities. An audit of the CPV program found some towns need to tighten standards for how they spend the money. KHNS's Emily Files reports.
The audit shows that Skagway receives more shared CPV funds from the state than any other town. From 2007 to 2015, the gateway to the Klondike got more than $30 million. Skagway and the other communities can't just spend that money however they want. There are three things it can be used for: port facilities, harbor infrastructure, or other services that provide for the cruise ships and their passengers. Chris Curtis is with the Legislative Audit Office.
It was just the area where expenditures for other CPV services to vessels and passengers, where they needed to improve documentation.
In Skagway's case, Curtis says one of those other services purchases did not follow regulations.
The municipality of Skagway Borough Management used CPV funds to purchase playground equipment for the Skagway Elementary School at a cost of $114,450. The audit concluded that the playground equipment primarily used for the elementary school does not qualify as an allowable purpose under the state or federal law.
Skagway Borough Manager Scott Hahn was not at the helm when the playground purchase was made in 2013, but he says there is a justification for it.
Skagway, unlike a lot of the other larger communities, is very much different because, you know, you go to Juneau, the population there, the general population, when you add the cruise ship population, it's only a little bit of a dent in what's going on there. Whereas here, it's completely consumed by the cruise ship activity.
He says the school is a primary emergency shelter for cruise ship passengers. There's also a huge influx of children in the summer with the arrival of seasonal workers and families on cruise ships.
It's somewhat directly connected to me, but it all depends how tightly you want to consider the impact. In Skagway, the impact is overwhelming and all-consuming.
Borough Treasurer Heather Rodig says records are unclear about why CPV funds were used on the playground equipment. She said it was a prior management decision that was made before she or Manager Hahn were in their current jobs. The other recommendations in the report have to do with Ketchikan and Sitka. Both places use CPV money for general municipal services. Curtis says the justifications to use CPV funds are vague.
Our audit found that two specific communities were not doing an adequate job in supporting the degree to which cruise ship passengers increased general municipal costs as evidence to support using CPV taxes to pay for general municipal operations.
Hahn says the Borough Assembly will discuss the CPV audit at a meeting this week.
I think this is maybe just kind of a wake-up call to try to, make sure everybody's doing the right thing.
He says the audit will help Skagway's government in future decisions to leverage CPV funds. In Haines, I'm Emily Files.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org, and you can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Zachariah Hughes and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Jillian Rogers and Emily Files in Haines, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Emily Russell in Nome. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Commercial, sport, subsistence, personal use. Some hear these labels and think conflict. The Salmon Project sees connections. Join 10,000 Alaskans whose lives are connected by Alaska's salmon. Visit salmonlife.org to experience the stories. And find the Salmon Project on Facebook to join the community. Salmon Life, Salmon Love. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.